We were on Daf Lamed Ches Amud Beis. Before the lines get wide, approximately about 11 lines or so before. The line actually, we're beginning at the beginning of the line, says Dag Maliach. The Gemara here is going to spend a fair amount of time, I mean at least the next half an Amud, just going through various types of foods and whether they were subject to Bishul Akum. So remember that the rule generally, the rule, what the Gemara seems to be focused on here is only one of the two criteria. The two criteria, which again were presented as alternatives, but we paskin lakula leniently using both of them, were presented on the top of Daf Lamed Ches Aban Aleph, that a food that is A, edible raw, or B, not olal shulchan malachim, whatever exactly means, it can't be served at a fancy meal, literally means goes up on a king's table. If either of those is met, or then it is not subject to Bishul Akum. For the food to be subject to the prohibition of Bishul Akum, it has to be A, inedible raw, and B, olal shulchan malachim. So it's the kind of thing where you've done something significant to transform the food, which was inedible otherwise, and it's the kind of food that can be served at a nice meal. So we're afraid that somehow creates greater social attraction, and they were afraid of intermarriage. So that's how they made the gezeirah. So now the Gemara is discussing a number of individual issues. So the Gemara says, Dag Maliach. If you have a salted fish. So the question is, what exactly is the Gemara talking about here? So Rashi says, Dag Maliach, it's actually way on top, the second arrow line, Rashi says, Shemilcho ha'oved kochavim, uvimlichaso hu nechal below bishul. So up until now, this is quite a novel point, the way Rashi is reading this Gemara. Well, we had assumed in reading Daf Lamed Ches Aman Aleph, and really from the start of the sugya on the bottom of Lamed Zayin Amid Beis, is that in order for something to be subject to the prohibition of Bishul Akum, Bishul means not merely transforming food into the edible, but it means actually using fire in order to transform the food. Now here, Rashi says, Dag Maliach means no, there was no fire. Literally, you just salted the fish, like you're curing it. And the question, and that alone, well, is how you've processed the fish, and a non-Jew does it. And the question is, what is the din? Now, what's complicated about Rashi's interpretation is that the Gemara, on the previous Amud that we had learned, discussed the very same issue, it seems. It says that the Gemara there said that Dagim Ketanim Alucham Ein Bahem Mishum Bishu Le'akum. It says there's no Bishul Akum when you're talking about small salted fish. It was followed by a line, Rabbi Yosef said, the way our Gemara reads, if a guy roasted them, then a Jew can rely upon it for Erev Tavshilin. That's what the Gemara said. So the question is, what does that mean? Does it mean that the guy salted the fish, and then the guy cooked it? Or Tosos took out the words guy. In other words, the Gemara there is talking about if a guy actually salted the fish, but obviously if it's going to be cooked subsequently, it's a Jew who has to do it. Now, the complicated thing about Tosfos' position, and the Rambam rejects it and the Ritva rejects it, when we mention this, is that the way the Rambam, and I believe the way we paskin, is that if a Jew, if anybody, renders the food edible via salting, at this point, the food is not subject to Bishul Akum at all. Why? Because you didn't use fire to prepare it. At this point, it doesn't matter what anybody does to it. Even if a guy comes along and cooks it now, so what? The bottom line is, what kind of a food did a guy take and cook now? He took a food that was edible as it is. It wasn't edible raw, but it was edible before he cooked it, which is usually the way we think about it, right? It's not whether the food's edible raw, it's whether or not, you know, if a Jew, for example, takes the food and he cooks it part of the way, enough to render it edible, enough to make it, let's say, machal ben drusai, and a guy finishes the cooking, so the assumption is, of course you're allowed to eat that. It was already edible, yeah.
But maybe the guy is advancing the food so that it's now olal shulchan malachim.
No. That's not the question that we're entertaining. We're not interested. We're going to assume that these sardines are olal shulchan malachim. That's a given in this discussion. Even though they are olal shulchan malachim, the discussion that's taking place is A, the status of the food, it's being edible or not being edible before it has been subject to bishul, and B, what the definition of bishul itself actually is. So the Rambam in the Ritva's position is that A, it has to be when the guy first sets his hands at it, it has to be inedible raw. And B, when we say when the guy first sets his hands at it, we means when he actually cooks it with fire. So in the case, if you were to take a case where a guy just salts the fish, one might have said that we would say it's not a problem bishlakim because it's not bishul. Nobody cooked it. It's just salted. And even if the guy subsequently cooked that fish, at least, and that may be the discussion here, but at least there already you can have the discussion. But what the Rambam and the Ritva will say that since what the guy cooked was something itself that was already edible, granted because he had salted it, but it wasn't cooked until now. It's not like it was partially cooked just enough to eat, and now he's cooking it further. No, the guy had salted it, and now he comes along and he takes what is an edible food, even though it's not cooked, and now he cooks it. That shouldn't change anything.
All right. If it improves it,
that doesn't matter. In other words, by the same, it's right. No different than if it's a Jew had cooked the food to Machal Ben Drusai, and then the guy cooks it from there subsequently. So when Marshall,
what about kind of changing mores about what is edible? Obviously, the assumption was that raw sardines could not be
eaten. Correct. So that's a given. That I think we discussed this a little bit one of the previous shurim, that to some extent it depends upon what is considered normally eaten in a particular society. Right? So we spoke about the question of sushi. And I think 30 years ago, pretty much almost no one here, you know, except for maybe people, maybe they were, I don't know, Japanese, or if they did, who ate fish raw. Nobody in our community, for the most part, ever ate fish raw. So it was dabar she'eino nechal kmo shulchai. And today, it's very clear, you know, you might argue that only sushi grade fish are subject to this leniency, as opposed to something that really couldn't be made. You know, it's not the same quality that it's ein nechal kmo shulchai, but undoubtedly, there's no question that it changes societally. To determine exactly how is hard. It's a little bit subjective. Just as, by the way, is olal shulchan malachim also. I hate these kinds of shaylas. The olal shulchan malachim shayla I hate completely, because I have no idea how to evaluate that. Especially in a day where they serve hot dogs and hamburgers at weddings. So, you know, maybe at the shmorgon, I don't know. But I don't even know how to process that anymore. So, I don't know, would they serve it at a White House dinner?
Jews, probably.
Okay, so anyway, so when the Gemara has that, so now let's come back. So the Gemara there spoke about Dagim Ketanim Luchim, there's no Bishul Akum, and Rabbi Yosef said if somebody cooked it, it's not clear, it's the guy or the Jew, then you can use it for Erev Tavshilin. Now, if you can use it for Erev Tavshilin, obviously it means it's mutter to eat, but the question is, who did the second stage of cooking? So if one assumes for the moment that the Gemara there did not have the question of, if the Gemara there was talking about, if a guy salts it, of course you can eat it. What happens if a guy cooks it after salting it? So if you could say that the Gemara, if you erase the words Ovei Kochavim, as Tosa suggests, on Lamech Hasem and Alef, then it means the Gemara never discussed that question. Does the Gemara on Lamech Hasem and Alef only address the question of what happens if a guy salts it? Not a problem. You know why? It's no fire involved. Now the Gemara is having a machlokas. Dag Maliach, if you went ahead and you cook it now it's a machlokas. Dag Maliach, Chiski, Asharif, Rabbi Yochanan, Osar. Okay, so in which case, the Rambam would probably say, I don't know how the Rambam, what he had on that Gemara earlier, but he would say the Rambam paskins, like Chizkiyah, that it's permissible, even though a Dag Maliach that a guy subsequently cooked is not a problem. Okay, what about Beitza? Tzuliyah, an egg that's roasted. So I don't know, the Chazan is not here, but I know there's a rumor has it that there are Chazanim who in the morning like to swallow a couple of raw eggs.
Right. Yes.
Adrian, that you thought that was very appetizing, apparently. I find it similarly appetizing.
Yes.
I think I'd rather falter on the Amud than die of botulism, but okay. But I don't know that renders it really considered an ochal. So I don't think people usually eat eggs raw.
Not but true. That's totally culturally dependent. In Japan, the most typical breakfast is being turned raw.
I'm only talking about here.
Okay.
I'm speaking to my own cultural experience. So I appreciate that it's limited and probably more limited than some people. Okay. So. So Beitza Tzluya, Bar Kapara Shari, Rabbi Yochanan Asar. Apparently Bar Kapara was from Japan and Rabbi Yochanan was from Tinek. Okay, so it is one of these, it's a funny kind of Gemara. The Gemara is having a machlokas about whether or not Beitza Tzluya is subject to this prohibition. The question is, the question is, what exactly is this kind of machlokas about? Is this a machlokas in Metzias? Is this the machlokas Marshall and I are having? In other words, did Bar Kappara and Rabbi Yochanan have different different practices in their communities? That's one possibility. It's not the possibility that Lomdim usually like to adopt, because it's very pedestrian, and it's strange to have such a machlokas, and it may not even be machlokas. The Gemara does, by the way, sometimes say, Marki Asrei, Umarki Asrei. Each one was ruling based upon his own place, because what was the norm in that place? The alternative, which is more appealing to the Lamdonim, except that it's very amorphous, is to argue that, no, it's a standard over what's called Nechal Kemo Shu Chai. In other words, presumably you can't eat the eggs raw. And presumably some people do, but the question is how common does it have to be that people eat the food raw to be considered Nechal Kemo Shu Chai, right? Because clearly you can, in a country of 300 million people, in this great country of ours, you presumably, any kind of strange behavior you can find, right? Any kind of incredibly noble behavior you can find, any kind of strange behavior you can find. The question is how frequently you find it, and then how do you define a norm? And how do you cut it down geographically? Those are all questions which I can't really answer, which is, again, what goes back to the question of why this is such a difficult kind of question to answer. But presumably, we would say Rabbi Yochanan and Bar Kappara are arguing about that. Unfortunately, the Gemara doesn't provide us even a hint, if they are arguing in those terms, what exactly are those lines. Okay, so now the Gemara quotes Ki Asa Rav Dimi. I'm sorry, but Ki Asa Rav Dimi. Rav Dimi came from Eretz Yisrael. So Amar Echad Dag Maliach Echad Beitz Atzluya Chiski Obar Kapara Sharu. The Rabbi Yochanan Aser. He said that there was a machlokes by both, and we have Chiski permitting the Dag Maliach, Bar Kappara permitting the Beitz Atzluya, and Rav Dimi said now both of them permitted Beitz Atzluya and Dag Maliach, and Rabbi Yochanan Aser, as we have the tradition both. So now the Gemara says, Rav Chia Parva'a Ikla the Bei Reish Galusa. Rav Chia Parva, we don't know, I don't know how frequently, if anywhere else he's found in Shas, who this is, came to the house of the Reish Galusa, the Exilar. So Amru Lo, Beitz Atzluya Mai. So the Avadim, it's well known throughout Shas, the Avadim in the house of the Exilar were not exactly the firmest Avadim. They were a difficult lot, and they could be a little thuggish also. So anyway, they asked Rav Chia Parva, what's the story of the Beitz Atzluya? So Amalahu, Chiski Obar Kapara Sharum, Rabbi Yochanan Asar, Chiski and Bar Kappara both permitted it, Rabbi Yochanan prohibited it, Vein Dvar Shel Echad B'Malkom Shnayim, and a one against two, so you follow a majority. Amar Huluhu Rav Zvid. Rav Zvid is standing there. He says, Lo Tatsisu Lei. Don't listen to him. Hachi Amar Abaye, Hilchasa Kivase to Rabbi Yochanan. Abaye said, we pass like Rabbi Yochanan in the Chumrah. Then what happened? The Avadim were not so happy because they didn't like the Chumrah. So Ashkiyuha Neguta Dachala, they made him drink some portion of vinegar. Vinach Nafshe. It means literally he dropped dead, but I suspect it means he passed out. Okay, which means that apparently the Avadim and the Reish Galusa's house were not to be messed with. And they asked the Shaila, they wanted a kula. You have to find them a kula. You might find yourself on the wrong side. Okay, so that's the story. Fine. It happens to be we paskin that a Beitz Atzluya is a problem. Dagma Leach is not a problem. Tan Rabbanan. Hakafrisin. Vahakaplutos. Vahamatalya. Vahachamin. Vahaklayo Shelahem. Mutarin. Shelahem here refers to all these. Shelahem means Shelgoyim. So these are five foods that the Braisa says are permitted. There's no concern of Bishalakim. Beitz Atzluya is Asura. Like Rabbi Yochanan's opinion, a roasted egg is prohibited. Shemen, and this should be familiar to all of us because we encountered this before. Shemen, Rabbi Yehuda Anasi, Beistino, Nimnu Alav, Vehitiruhu. So Rabbi Yehuda Anasi and his Beistin, so they permitted Shemen Shalakum. As we know from elsewhere, as the Rishonim point out, this was not Rabbi Yehuda Anasi, the author of the Mishnah, this was Rabbi Yehuda Nasi'a, his grandson. And his Beis Din was matir two things, and they wanted to be matir, I think it was Pasakum, and he said, I don't want to do that because then they'll call me a Beis Din Shaira. They'll call me a permissive Beis Din. Fine. So it's a good lesson to young rabbis. You know, save your coolers because you only get two of them. I don't know, like, if there's an expiration date that you cycle around, okay, it's been forgotten that I gave these coolers and now I can press the reset button.
What when you're machmer, you know, like that.
Oh, if you substitute, I see, okay, the question is, can you trade those in? Fine. So that was the story with you, the Nesiyah.
That one's a trivia.
All right. So we have to go through what are the items in this Braisa. Just one comment about the end. You'll notice the Braisa is against Chizki and Bar Kapara. So the question is, why doesn't the Gemara present this as a tufta, as a kasha against them? So Tosus just points out that first that he says that Chizki and Bar Kapara are Tanoim. They might be. They're just about old enough to be. So besides which, this Rabbi Yehuda Nasi in the Braisa is later than they are. So it's not like you're going to ask a if he's recorded in this Braisa, it's obviously a late enough Braisa. It's not going to be a challenge to their authority. Okay, but be that as it may, what are the items in the Braisa? Kafrisin. If anybody's ever learned the sixth parak of Brachos, you discover a very interesting plant there. The Gemara has some very interesting observations about the botanical aspects of a caperberry bush. Caperberry bush is a plant that is sort of native to the Mediterranean. You can find in the store. I know when they sell in Gladys Barcentina caperberries. They look like, I don't want to say shrunken olives. They're very tiny. They tend to be the color of green olives, at least the ones I've seen.
They're available raw now. Five times the size.
Okay. So there are various parts of this plant at various stages that are subject to an extensive discussion in Brachos, in the beginning of the sixth parak, as to what their brachos are, what their status is with respect to, are they a fruit, are they a vegetable in terms of orla, and so on. The kafrisin are some type of a thing, like a protective bud around the fruit itself, and some people would be sholeik them, they would cook them really well, and they would eat them. So kafrisin are permitted. I assume it's because they're nechal kamo shuchai. Kaplutos, Rashi says, are karti, are leeks. So it's a member of the onion family. You probably don't eat too much of it raw, but you can eat raw onion and garlic. It's not, a little too much of it, you may find yourself with an upset stomach. Then a matalia, which I'm going to leave alone for the moment because the Gemara is going to explain what it is. Hachamin is hot water, and haklayos are roasted wheat kernels. So in the case of chamin and klayos, as the Gemara stated at the beginning of the sugya on the bottom line, zayman and beis, those are not actually considered nishtanu. In other words, it's not enough simply to cook something, but somehow it has to be considered nishtane al yedei ha'or. So for whatever reason, the Gemara assumed that simply roasting the wheat kernels itself does not constitute hishtanus. Grinding with the flour would constitute a change, except that doesn't entail cooking, so that's not a problem either. So Rashi says both chamin and klayos are not really changed via the fire. Okay, water we certainly understand. You heat the water up, it cools down, it's the same thing. It's not as obvious when it comes to klayos, when it comes to roasted wheat kernels, because they are changed, right? When you let them cool down, they're cool popcorn now, as opposed to hot popcorn, but they're not raw kernels anymore. Okay. Anyway, be that as it may, I don't know, do klayos pop at all, like popcorn?
Sure, it's the same as
it's the same kind of blows up? Oh, that's pretty cool. I've never seen it. I've never seen it in the store. You know, wheat kernels
puffed
for popping.
Puffed wheat, puffed rice.
Okay, fine. So, the Gemara now says, Tanya, on the second wide line, Hi hamatalia, hi fashalia, hi shiasa. Which, of course, you look at this braisa, and it says matalia is the same thing as pashalia and shiasa. And, of course, you look at this, and Josh says, of course, well, I know what those are. Like, that's pretty obvious. So the Gemara says, my shiasa, thank you very much, but that doesn't help us. So what is shiasa? Amar Rabba Bar Chana, Amar Rabbi Yochanan. Ha arboin shenin denafikai uvda mimitzrayim. Ve Rabba Bar Chana didei amar haishitin shenin denafikai uvda mimitzrayim. So apparently, this story came from Egypt. When he quoted Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Yochanan said, it's been 40 years since this story first arrived in Eretz Yisrael. Rabbi Archana said, when he would say this himself, he'd say it's been 60 years. And the Gemara says, but pligi, mar b'shnei. Rabbi Archana was a Talmud of Rabbi Yochanan, so let's say he's about 20 years younger. So, or when he heard Rabbi Yochanan say it, Rabbi Yochanan said it was 40 years since the story happened. And later, Rabbi Archana is quoting the story, and it had been 60 years since Rabbi Yochanan reported, 20 years since Rabbi Yochanan reported the story, 60 years since the story happened. So what's the story? What's the deal with this stuff? So the Gemara says, "Hechi avadu." How do they do this? Maisu bizra de karpisa. Bizra is short for probably barzera. It means the seeds of. I think the targum of. In Pasuk and Parshas Bereishis, in the creation of. Eitz peri osa pri limino asher zarovo. So they say debar zara be. That's what zarovo means. So bar zara bizra is a contraction. It means the seeds. So you take the seeds of karpas. I don't know if that's actually parsley or some other green. Ubizra the kisna, and the seeds of flax. Ubizla the shablilta. Rashi says is fenugreek, which is a kind of legume.
A fenugreek.
And you take them, and v'taru lahu bahadeh hadadi. Taru means shriya in Hebrew. It means to soak. You soak them together bipshure in warm water, not hot water. You can do it in warm water, and apparently that's probably the reason why there's no bishul akum here. Ushvakule, and they leave it ad demikabel. Rashi says until it sprouts. Right? If you take various kinds of seeds, you put them in water, and they will sprout. Then umaisi chatzvechadete, you bring new barrels, probably earthenware barrels, umalaluhumaya, and you fill them with water, vitaru bahu gargishta. And then you soak in them, Rashi says, arzila. I don't know what exactly is. And then you take umedabkin bay, they would somehow stick these sprouts inside the barrel, the island lebei bane, and then you go to the bathhouse for an hour or two. I'm not sure you have to go to the bath. Maybe part of it, but I'm not sure. Adenafaku. By the time you come out malavlovi, it's already starting to flower. Va'achli minayhu, and then you eat from it. V'kairi, and it cools you down. Mibinasa dereshayu atufra dekarayu. From it, we would say from head to toe. Right? Now, apparently, that probably you're supposed to go to the bathhouse because you go from the heat to the cold and it makes you sweat and whatever else, and they assume that this had a therapeutic effect. I'm not sure we do, but so that's the story. That is what fashalia is. That's what fashalia is. So Rashi comments that Rashi Dibar Maskel may be Nasa de Reshayu, Seir Roshan, from the head on your hair to the toenail, from the nails on your toes. The Kamash Malan Braisa, the Inami Taro Labachemi Meshari. The Braisa is telling you that even if you soaked it in hot water, it would also be permissible. In other words, there's no question if you soak it in warm water, that's not Bishul. But even if you did it in Bishul, Rashi says that's what the Gemara is telling you would not be a problem. Now, the coda to the story is Amar Ravashi. Amar li Rabbi Chanina milin, v'amri la mimilin. So what is this very strange? Rabbi Chanina said to me, words or with words? So Rashi explains that there were two versions of what Rabbi Chanina said to him. One is milin. He says this is nonsense. These words, they made up the story. It never happens. There's no way that the stuff flowers that quickly from the time you enter the bathhouse till you leave. The alternative is that it's also impossible that normally, in a natural means, it could flower that quickly. So instead, bimilin means they would use kishuf, they would use lachash, they would use
amulet.
Yeah, I know, but they would use words for it.
Amulet.
Incantations. Thank you. They would use incantations. Bimilin was the way that it would sprout that quickly. But there's no way either this never happened or it didn't happen by natural means. Okay. So that's what the Braisa says, that these things, with the exception of Beit Tzatzluya, are all considered either Necholim Kamo Shulchayim, or they're not Nishtana way they are, and it's not a problem. Fine. Tanu Rabbanon. Hakuspan shel Oveit Kochavim. Rashi says it's the remainders of the dates, the psolas of the dates. Now, what's the issue with it? So, Hakuspan shel Oveit Kochavim. Shehuchmu. Chamin biyore gedola aser biyore katana mutter. So if you sort of boil them in hot water, in a large pot it's aser, in a small pot it's mutter. Ve'ezo hi yore katana, and what is a considered? What's a small pot? And this will actually start to explain what the Gemara's concern was. Amar Rav Yanai kol she'ein tzipor dror yochali kanis besocha. A tzipor dror is a pretty small bird. If the small bird cannot find its way, cannot burrow its way into this pot, then you don't have a problem. Now, why is that the criteria? So now the Gemara asks a question. V'dilma admuye admuha v'ainuha. Maybe they chopped up the bird, and that's how they caused it to enter. Literally, the ailua, they managed to put it inside. The concern is that the guy might have cooked non-kosher food here, in this pot. It's a treif pot. So the Gemara says that how do you know they didn't chop up the treif bird? Ela kosher in rosh tzipar dror yochel likanis besocha. If the head of a tzipar dror is too large to fit into the entrance to this pot, then it's not a problem if they cooked in that pot. Meaning, they're not going to put a chaticha of basar, of a meat in there. The pot is going to be too small for that. And therefore, you don't have to worry about the pot is actually a treif pot. So that's why the Braisa distinguishes between the kuspan, the date stuff that was prepared in a big pot versus a small pot. But now the Gemara asks, V'atanya, achasiyar gedola, v'achasiyar katana mutter. There's another brisa that says it doesn't matter what pot they used it in, it's perfectly permissible. So the Gemara says, Lokasha, ha kemanda amar no sein tam lefkam aser, ha kemanda amar no sein tam lefkam mutter. So we mentioned this before, but it's worth repeating, which is, the assumption of the Gemara is that if you cook in a pot that hasn't been used for 24 hours, any flavor that is emitted by that pot is going to damage the food. It's going to be no same time. It may not render it edible. It is not going to enhance the food. If anything, it's going to detract from the food. It's called no same tam lifgam. There is a machlokas later, Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Shimon, whether or not no same tam lifgam is permitted or not. The Gemara quotes a pasuk. Rabbi Shimon quotes a pasuk. The Torah says you're not allowed to eat a nevela, an animal that died without a proper slaughtering, a proper shechita. Lo sochlu chol nevela, la gera sher b'sharenecha titnenu va'achala. You should give it to the stranger, you know, the ger toshav who lives in your cities, and he can eat it because he's not commanded to not eat nevela. So the Gemara says that nevela haruya la ger kriya nevela, nevela she'ena kriya la ger ena kriya nevela. If a nevela is edible by a ger, it means by a person, you can eat it too. It's just that it's usher to eat. Then that's considered nevela. If it is inedible by the ger, cannot eat it, then it is not prohibited. That is Rabbi Shimon's position, Nosen Tam Lefgam is Mutter. Rabbi Meir has his own interpretation. So the assumption that we work with is that a pot, after 24 hours, the flavor that it's going to, that it might put into the food is going to be detrimental, not positive. And therefore, there's a machlokas. If you hold that Nosen Tam Lefgam is Mutter, then the food is actually going to be kosher. Now, just a couple of comments in terms of both realia and in terms of what it means for halacha. In terms of realia, this would seem, the whole issue of pots absorbing and whether the flavor is detrimental or favorable seems a little strange to us because we cook in pots that essentially don't absorb. I just have sitting unopened at home a box that I purchased of a earthenware pot. An earthenware, I don't mean China, glazed china, I mean a true earthenware pot, which I'm told absorbs a tremendous amount and you can really tell, but I'm going to find out. So I'm going to cook food in it and then I'm going to cook other food in it afterwards if it's clean and we're going to see what happens. Now, there are, and I suspect that it's very clear that Chazal were not living in another planet. They were dealing with the reality in front of them. We are just happy to be dealing with a different reality because, you know, most of our pots, like cast iron is an exception. Cast iron does absorb, in fact. But most of our pots, the stainless steel and the aluminum and whatever else, you know, either Teflon coated stuff, do not absorb, right? But it's not that their pots didn't absorb, but they just were dealing with very different kinds of pots. Our china doesn't absorb because our china is glazed, but their china was not glazed. So I'll report back on the results of my experiments, you know, probably after the Chag or some point. But anyway, so that's one consideration. The other thing to consider in a very serious way is that they didn't have emulsifiers or good emulsifiers or readily available hot water sometimes for the washing of dishes. And without that, it's very hard to get dishes clean. Try, in fact, even with a sink, try getting plastic clean. And you know, not the Lucide plastic, but try getting, you know, like your Tupperware plastic clean in the sink. Even with hot water and soap, it's pretty hard. My dishwasher does a great job, but these dishwashers don't do such a great job. It's really hard to get all the greasy film off. So you can imagine that if you took a pot that had this greasy film and you leave it around a certain amount of time, you could understand why at some point it's going to be putrid, why it would actually be no sin tam lefgam. It actually, it all makes sense in a different cultural context, in a different reality, a different mitzius. So anyway, the bottom line, what this means for us, though, is we happen to and that no sin tam lefgam is mutter, which is why when, as a rabbi gets a shaila and someone accidentally, you know, used the wrong pot, they used the fleshik pot and they cooked milchuk stuff in it. So first you have to make sure that the pot was really used with fleshik, and then you have to make sure that the food they cooked in it is genuinely milchuk. But let's say it was their fleshik frying pan, and they put butter in this frying pan now, forgetting they thought it was their milchuk frying pan. So the first question, and then they cooked, you know, lots of food, and then they have it on the table. The guests are coming in 30 minutes, and the question is, Rabbi, what do I do? So you get that shaila, and you feel like you're the conquering hero. Not a problem. The pot, you're going to have to kosher, but the food is perfectly fine. The food is perfectly fine. If you didn't use the pot 24 hours before, then any absorptions that the pot might have had that it might emit into the milk are considered no sein tam lefgam. So the food you cook in it is 100% glatt kosher. Not a question whatsoever. You're not allowed to cook in a pot even after 24 hours. And so I just provide a great solution. Who needs the kasher for Pesach? Just go on vacation. You know, go out to a restaurant, breakfast, lunch, and supper 24 hours before we solve our problem. As long as the pots are clean, no problem. So it is a problem because the Chachamah made gzeira that you're not allowed to cook in a pot, which is an eno benyomo, lest you come to cook in a benyomo. Benyomo means within the day, lest you come to cook in it, and then you're going to end up eating treif food. So l'chatchila, you're not allowed to cook in a pot that is treif after 24 hours, that is to cook the reverse milk or meat after 24 hours, but it does not aser the food. That's obviously a tremendously, tremendously important kula. The pot will now be treif for a very simple reason. If I took a fleishik, I should correct that. The pot is not treif. If I have a fleishik frying pan, and I used it after 24 hours, it was clean, I used it for 24 hours with milk, I can cook vegetables in it, but I can't cook milk in it, and I can't cook meat in it. Why? I can't cook milk in it because it was a fleishik pot to start with. Even after 24 hours, there's still a gzeira midrabanan. And even if I wait 24 hours now, because I cooked milk in it, I can't cook meat in it either, because it's also a milchik pot. It's not a basar, it's not treif the pot, because the basar and the chalav never met when they were both benyomo, and they're both, you know, fresh and edible. So it's like I have a pot that's both fleishiks and milchiks, can't be used with milk because it's fleishik, can't be used with meat because it's milchik, but I can cook vegetables in it. And after 20, even for Ashkenazim, certainly after 24 hours, the vegetables are parv. Okay? It's not the kind of the pot you want to have lying around. You want to kosher that pot, but right. By the same token, if you have a treif pot, for some reason the pot was treif. I don't know, maybe somebody has a liver pan or something like that, and it hasn't been used for 24 hours, so it's the assumption it might be balua of blood. Nonetheless, after 24 hours, it's not going to prohibit the food that you cook in it. There is one exception to this rule, which actually, the source for which is in our Mishnah, which we read quickly, but we didn't discuss extensively. The source happens to be, and we won't get to it today, but it's called chiltis. The Mishnah says that you can't buy chiltis from a guy. Why can't you buy, what is chiltis? It's astafotida. It's this very foul-smelling kind of, I think it's a resin, a very gummy resin. I think it originally is from Persia, and it's still used in cooking. It's called asta futida. The word futida is the same word as fetid. It means it stinks. It's apparently very, very pungent, very sharp, and the concern is the guy cut it with a knife. The guy cut it with a knife, and while ordinarily if he cut with his treif knife, and Rashi says there's still shamnunis, there's still fat residue on the knife, but we are machmir to say even if there's no fat residue on the outside of the knife, even if the knife is just balua, let's say, of treif stuff, or whatever the knife is below in, we assume that into something like chiltis, even though normally the rule would be no sein tam lufgam es mutter, the chiltis, the sharp food, that has the effect of making that which the kli gives off, it makes it actually no sein tam l'shvach. That's the assumption, that chiltis sweetens whatever the blios that come out, even after 24 hours. Now, we tend to be very machmir on this, and we have to put together a lot of chumras, which I'm going to wait to explore them in detail until we get to the Gemara, but we tend to treat other sharp, it's a question, what is considered sharp? So I would generally say probably onions, then the onion family, when they're raw, are sharp, which is, that's the common case that comes up. So somebody calls the rabbi and says, I took a milchik knife, and I would cut up onions for the chulent. Then I tossed them in. And there's meat, and it's in a meat pot, and there's meat in the chulent. And the question is, what is the story? So if they weren't onions, if you chopped up, I don't know, if you took a hot knife and you stirred parsley, okay, and you tossed that into the chulent, if the knife wasn't used for 24 hours, not a problem. You weren't supposed to do that, but it's no sein tam. Anything in that knife is no sein tam lufgam. The parsley is parv. You can throw it into the chulent, not a problem. But if you chop something sharp with it, then the assumption is if it was a milchik knife, the milk blios in the knife, and that's a first question you have to ask, of course, is it really a milchik knife? Right? Probably the knife that I, you know, my silverware, the place settings that I cut at the table is probably not really a milchik knife. You probably never used it with anything that's hot enough to constitute, make the knife actually milchik. But if you had your really milchik knife, and you chop the onions, now the onions are assumed to absorb milk from the knife, and now when you toss that into the pot, the chillin pot, you have to start to make a calculation, well, what is the stat, how much milk is there? The good news here, at least, is, without explaining a larger sugya in your day, is that the only thing you have to worry about is the volume of the knife. The maximum amount of milk that the knife could have absorbed is the full volume of the knife. Now we know the knife did not absorb that much milk. But even the worst case scenario, and if you have 60 times in the entire food, in the entire chulent, you have 60 times the volume of the blade of the knife, then you're safe. It usually won't be a problem unless it's a small, big chulent, small knife. And so then you
small
could wind up in a
big knife.
Small chulent, big knife. Yes, yes. Sorry. Yes.
But why sharp? I didn't get that part.
The assumption the Gemara is going to make, we'll see it on Daf Lamed Tesam and Aleph, is that the effect of chiltis is to take blios and to be mechalyale, which means to sweeten them, means to render them edible, render them as positive. I don't know, as not being someone who's very, A, has a sensitive palate, and B, is involved in any way, you know, in cuisine, I can't really tell you this. I suspect that if you find someone who's a chef, they can probably describe to you the process that's being described here. Right? You can understand, just as the Gemara will say, there are certain foods, for example, in principle, you can check with your local Hadex rabbi, but a pure, 100% pure honey does not require hashgacha, according to, I believe, the Shulchan Aruch. And the reason for that is that the Gemara says it. And it's a question whether they mean honey or they mean something made from honey. The Gemara says that what doesn't matter, even if you cooked honey in a treif pot, anything that, any, let's say, treif meat in that pot that would go into the honey is no Saint Tom Lefkan. Even if it's fresh pot, freshly used pot, not after 24 hours. Now, there are different foods have different effects on the food, on flavors that are sort of induced into them. So just as honey always takes even a Tom Meshubach and makes it Pogum, and it's detrimental to the honey, there are some foods that apparently even a Tom Pogum is beneficial in. So I can't tell you why, but that's the assumption here.
And lemons and garlic and all the same.
Garlic is the onion family. So lemons are a question that's discussed. The question is whether lemons are, I'm not sure if lemons are not sharp the way onions are. It's a different, but some would say lemons also fall in that category. So when Poskim deal with this question, one of the things, again, there are a lot of chumras being put together here, but one chumra that Poskim will sometimes invoke as an argument for leniency is that maybe only chiltis is sharp and we don't treat anything else as really being sharp.
What about using separate knives, just a set of power of the knives just for sharp?
I'll tell you where it really comes out. This is one thing my wife made me schlep out, the rightfully so, I deserve to, but I'm the rabbi, so if it's Paskin, it's usher, is to pull out the power of frying pan. She wanted to saute onions for a soup, and she asked me, I said, that's the one thing, if your pots were not benyomo, you could use your milchuk or fleishuk pot to cook almost anything. If you cook rice in a meat pot, but the meat pot hasn't been used for 24 hours, the rice is parv. The rice is 100% parv. But if you're frying onions...
Put it on a dairy plate.
What's that? Absolutely. Sephardim are more lenient than Ashkenazim. Sephardim allow you to cook in a benyomo pot. For a Sephardi, if you took your pot, you made meatballs in it, you clean it out thoroughly, run it through the dishwasher, or clean it really well, and now cook noodles in it, the noodles are parv. That's a sugi in chulin. It's dagim shal lebakar. It's called not... What?
I thought you said not
lechatchila. I said Sephardim only.
Sephardim.
Sephardim. For Ashkenazim, if the pot's not a benyomo, so there are some who say you can't do lachatchila, but I think it's once the pot's not a benyomo, not only is the food, everybody agrees, the food is not milchik or fleishik, whichever you're cooking in, but you could do that lachatchila.
So you could put cheese on top of the rice.
Yeah. That's correct. That's correct. Right, so Sephardim are much more makel. The Sephardim hold that you can do it lachatchila, and that's the expression not barnat, no Saint Tom bar no Saint Tom. In other words, the meat put flavor into the pot put flavor into the rice. That's already a secondary flavor, and since there's nothing also, even if the rice were fleishik, it would be mutter. But since it's mutter, the secondary Tom Sephardim say doesn't count at all. Ashkenazim are machmir for a minority opinion and say that you would need a third knot. You need knot bar knot bar knot, or if it's not a benyoma. If it's not a benyoma. Marshall.
So, getting back to knives for a second. So, yeah. We're back at our vacation house. We just got back from the supermarket with the Rabbi Weider Italian bread. We're very happy about that. And now we want to cut it open.
Do you take my chumras too, by the way?
So, the question is, you have a knife block set in the rental house.
Yeah.
You can't use them at all. You assume they're not bar yoma. You run them through the dishwasher. You
kosher them. Just boil a pot of water. You can assume it's not a benyomo, but
do hagala on the
nice. That's all.
and there's no chumra, like the handles might be integrated, and you can't, because like for Pesach, you couldn't kosher them for sure, right?
It's not true. I don't know where this comes from. The Gemara says Rav Ashi used to kosher his knives. He says, Katayu Betina Uparzala Benura. He would first cover the handle in with mud, and then he would do libon as a chumrah on the blade, and then he would go turn around and do hagal on the handle.
It's a wooden handle?
Yes, that's why he had to put mud around it.
What's libon?
Libon is a fire. Right. He put the blade in fire, which is a chumrah. We only needed to do it, but idi v'idim. The Gemara says, and hilchasa idi v'idim berotchen. So this thing that flows around a two-part knife. If the knife is loose, the handle, that's a separate question. But if it's solid the way it was made, kibolo kach polto.
Right, so you're saying literally just boil the knife set in the biggest pot in the house and they're ready to go.
And you're done.
Yeah. You know, the minhag of Ashkenazim is we don't kosher things that are ben yomo, but as long as you can assume reasonably that the knives are not, haven't been used in 24 hours and they're clean, so you can kosher them. Yeah.
What about in the knife block? You might have stuff.
If you're concerned about that, wipe it. It's highly likely you just wipe it off. Yeah. There is something about that, actually. The Rama has a chumrah in Hilchos Pesach about the Maril, because they apparently had leather sheets, and not to use them on Pesach, because it was impossible to clean inside. Mm-hmm. So there is such a concern, but do you leave the knives out?
Mm-hmm. Is that the same thing with the barbecue set? I mean, let's say you're renting and they have a barbecue set.
No, that's more complicated, because then you're going to have to do libun.
Yeah, that makes sense.
That you're law likely have to do libun. Well, it depends.
Just turn on the barbecue.
Turn the barbecue, right?
Right. So,
you turn it on.
If it's clean, theoretically, you can...
You mean the tools or the grill?
He's talking about the tools, I thought.
But the grill itself also? You can make it red hot?
They melt long before you got them.
No. But you don't. There are different opinions of poskim. Many poskim are makel to assume kibolo kach potos if you heat it to its hottest setting. The way we tell people to kosher an oven when it doesn't have a self-cleaning cycle on it is turn it up to its highest temperature for an hour. Right, clean it through that. Why? Because the assumption is kibolo kach potos. If that's the heat it absorbed, that's the heat it emits at. Not everybody agrees to that, but that's, I think, pretty common practice.
But why would that be true for a barbecue tongs?
It would be, you have to leave it in the flame.
Right, that's my point. That's
you're telling me?
You couldn't.
Okay.
There's no way you
anyway.
Could I just ask one more question on the knife?
Sure.
If you're cutting like a hot omelet with your milchuk knife, that doesn't make a milchuk? You're saying it's likely.
No, an omelet, because an omelet's not, if the knife is not benyomo, an omelet's not davar charif, it's not sharp.
So what would you have to, like, how would you make a knife milchuk? Give me, like, one example. Of
oh, you're saying, how does the knife in the first place? You'd have to, I'm sorry. The omelet is milchuk, you mean. It's got cheese in it.
Yeah, I'm saying.
Yes, that would make the knife milchuk, yes. Correct. Particularly if it's on the flame and when you're still cutting it there. Yeah. Okay, so anyway, there's more to that. We may talk a little more when we get to Chiltis in a couple of shiurim from now, but let's come back to our Gemara for the moment. That's the No Sein Talmud of Gam story. So, Amar Rav Sheshes.
Where are you?
All right, so we are, let's say, we did take a little vacation from the text. It's about 11 or 12 lines up from where the lines get really wide at the bottom. So in the medium-sized line, 11, the 11th, the last line.
Okay.
Okay, it's actually 12th. Amar Rav Sheshes. Hai mishcha shlika daramoi osur. He says, if you have oil of a non-Jew that was cooked, it's prohibited. Now, here remember, shemen shel akum itself is not a problem, right? That we've already established. A non-Jew's olive oil, why? Well, they didn't make a gzeira on it specifically, and it's raw. It's raw. It's not cooked. It's right. It's cold-pressed. But now somebody apparently took olive oil and they cooked it. So the question is, what is the din? So Rav Sheshe said it's aser, but Amar Rav Safra, Rav Safra disagrees. He says, "Lamai nechashla, what are you worried about? If you're concerned that they mix a little bit of wine into the oil when they cook it, so he says that's not a problem. Misrasari, it causes it to rot or to it causes it to spoil faster. They're not going to mix wine into the olive oil. And imishum bishulei akum, if it's because of bishul akum." Nechal kamoshu chai. The oil could have been used raw. That's how it normally is used. Imi shum giule akum. But maybe the kli in which you cook the oil was treif. The answer is no sein tam of gam hu umutar. The kli is no sein tam of gam. Now there's an assumption that's being made here that the Balei Tosfos point out, which is that stam kelim einam b'nei yomim. We assume, and this assumption you have to actually know based upon your society and your normal use, you have to know whether it's still really true, is that most kelim are not b'nei yomim. And as you walk into your kitchen, the assumption, if a guy cooks on his kitchen, the assumption is he probably hadn't cooked with that pot for at least 24 hours. It seems to be some statistical assumption. And I think it's probably true, in our kitchen, it's certainly the case that probably if you took out 3/4 of the pot, some of them haven't been used in a year, but even the ones that get frequent use, the statistical probability is they haven't been used within 24 hours. In fact, there is another, we assume 24 hours is the period of Ben Yomo, but there's another lenient position within that that we never accept outright, which is the position of Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam, it's in the last daf in our Masechta, it's quoted, I think, at the top of Daf Ayin Vav and Aleph. Rabbeinu Tam claimed that to be an Eino Ben Yomo, you only need Linas Laila. If you had the entire night period, if the pot was used, let's say, during the day, when the entire night has passed over, by the next morning, it's now called Eino Ben Yomo. Which means it could be as little as, 10, 11, 12 hours. It doesn't even have to be 24 hours. So we generally are not lenient for Rabbeinu Tam's position unless it's in combination with other reasons to be lenient. But it's a sort of a shita that's there. Posse keeps that in his, if not in his front pocket, in his back pocket, and when he's got, three other reasons, none of which themselves are enough, but in combination he may throw this is like throwing in the kitchen sink, is Rabbeinu Tam's position. Okay, so but the assumption of the Gemara here of Safra is that Stam Kalim ain't a Bnei Yomim. Most Kalim are not Bnei Yomim. If you're talking about a restaurant that's open 6 days a week, you can't work with that assumption anymore. Right, because you presume they're cooking in the pots almost on a constant basis, certainly on a daily basis, much of the day. Even if they get unless the restaurant for Rabbeinu Tam closes before sunset and opens after sunrise, and that doesn't help you if you hold like what we hold, which is 24 hours. The kelim are typically not b'nei yomim. But this rule is subject to sort of I'll call verification on some level. It's not that you can walk into any circumstance and say, oh, stam kelim not b'nei yomim, I don't have to worry. But in situations where that presumption in fact holds true, then one can rely upon that. So food that was cooked in the goy's kelim, kosher food that was cooked in a non-Jew's kelim, is probably kosher. Leaving aside the question of davar harif, the sharp foods. Yes, Marshall.
So that's true for any individual pot, but the question is, would it be true for all the kelim in the aggregate? Because there it would seem like...
You mean if you took your food and you ran it through each pot? Probably not.
Right, or if, for example, to be tachlis, like you arrive at a vacation house, and there's a knife block. You can't be sure that all the knives are benyama, even though here you could assume that each individual knife is benyama. So are you allowed to kosher them that day and use them that night if someone else checked out of the house that morning? Because the math doesn't hold from a probability theory perspective if you need all the knives.
Good question.
So probably if you came and asked me the shaila, in real time, I would start to ask you a series of other questions, would suggest that probably the knives are ben yomo, because even the knife that's not a ben yomo, who says it was used with hot stuff, and who says the stuff that it was used is with treif, right? So I could put together enough things probably to tell you that if it were important enough to do it, you could probably kosher them. You see, the ironic thing is that it's not the kasher of ben yomo is more. I said it's a minhag of Ashkenazim. Ashkenazim don't kasher anything ben yomo. Al pidin, you can kasher milk. Milchiks, which is ben yomo, you can kasher fleishiks, which is ben yomo. Kashering something treif, which is a ben yomo, is actually much more complicated for reasons I'm not going to explain now, but God willing, a couple of years we'll get to the sugya of hachsher kelim. We can talk about why that is and what the problems of kashering something that's treif when it's still ben yomo. It can be done, but the requirements actually grow greater. But I think given that you're dealing with knives, in the aggregate of everything, you're probably is not an issue. Probably not an issue. I could also get into the question of bittul, that knife might be bittul amongst the other knives. I'm not saying that jokingly, right? This is a classic shaylin yerdeh. If one of your forks gets trafed up, and then your knuckleheaded spouse, okay, I picked gender neutral here, your knuckleheaded spouse puts it back in the drawer, and now you don't know which fork it is. Do you apply the principle bittul berov there? The Shulchan Aruch Paskins, I believe that you do, although it may have changed today because it's much easier to kasher stuff today. But anyway, that's a discussion to be had.
I don't think that's analytically relevant because...
It is, because there's one...
Example, hold on, give me one second. In that example, you know that everything else in the drawer is kosher. There's only one that's not in its bittul. In the knife block example, you have no reason to know statistically that the majority have not been used in the last 24 hours.
Well, again, if you are actually afraid of the majority, that's a different shaila. But I think the assumption, unless you think the probability of a majority of those knives having been used, you know, in problematic circumstances is probably very low in the first place, right? You're not talking about something that's used with cold. You're not talking, again, you have to have real tarfus. It has to be used with hot, right? So I suspect that you're automatically starting out with a small probability that there's any knife that in fact is problematic, at least for kashering purposes, for sure.
Right. Okay. So anyway, going on in the Gemara, so that was Rav Stafferson, and that's the way we paskin. Bo minim Rabbi Yossi, they asked Rabbi Yossi, Hani ahine shlike da aramoi. If you have these dates that were cooked by non-Jews, my, what's the status? Now, what's going behind the Gemara's question here is the following. There are some dates that are inedible raw. They're very, they're tamarim hamarim, right? They're very bitter dates. They have to be cooked. So the Gemara says as follows. Chuli in Aramaic means sweet. So chulye lo tibay lach devadai sharu. Of course you can eat them if the guy cooked them because they're edible raw. Mirire lo tibay lach, the really bitter ones, no question that they're prohibited. Devadai asiri kiti bay, because they're not edible raw. Kiti bay lach, you know what you have to ask about? Mitzi ay, the in-between ones, right? This is the problem. What happens is it's sort of edible but not completely edible. So amar lahu, so my Amar Lahu, my Tibai Lahu, what's the question? The Rabbi Asar, that our teacher prohibited Umanu Levi. Levi said, if the Tamarim are only ne'echalim al yidei adchak, if they can only be eaten raw with great, I don't know how to, being pressed, then that's not called edible raw. It has to be comfortably edible raw. Okay. Now the Gemara talks about shisisa'a. Rashi explains it's a cooked food that's made from flour of roasted wheat that was dried out in the oven. Some make it from wheat and barley, and some make it from adoshim, from lentils. Apparently the stuff made from lentils was really, really sweet, and they added vinegar to sort of dampen some of the sweetness to render it edible. So what's the shaila with, of course, adding vinegar? Well, the vinegar is the problem. The vinegar would typically be made from wine. So the question is, if you have shisisa'a, do you have to be concerned that the non-Jew mixed in wine, mixed in vinegar, which is made from wine? And remember, vinegar cannot become yayin nesach. But wine, which became yayin nesach, hostaminam, and turns into vinegar, is still prohibited. So the Gemara says as follows. Rav Shari, Avua deshmo v'levi asri. So Rav permitted it, and he's not concerned about wine being mixed in, and Shmuel and Levi prohibited it. Now the Gemara explains what kind of shisisa were they arguing about. Bechite v'sare kule amalo pligi d'shari. Everybody agrees that if you're dealing with that made from wheat or barley, where they don't need to put vinegar in, you don't assume that they did. And you don't worry. You don't have to worry that if they let you eat that, you'll come to eat the stuff where they might put vinegar in. Ki pligi, the bitap. If it's made from lentils with vinegar, you know it was used with vinegar, it's prohibited. What if they made it with from lentils, but they only used water in it? One position, Avua de Shmuel and Levi prohibit. They don't allow you to eat water adashim, whatever you want to call this food, because you might eat the adashim, which are typically made, very commonly made with vinegar. But they don't prohibit with the wheat or the barley. Umar savar lo gazrinan, and Rav says, no, we're not concerned. The ika da amri, they're those who have it more stringent. Everybody agrees that if it's made with lentils, if the shisisa is made from lentils, because lentils very often have vinegar mixed in, we don't allow you to eat it made by a non-Jew, even if it was made only with water. However, ki pligi bechite v'sare, if it's away from wheat or barley, mar savar gazrinan ha'atuhar, umar savar lo gazrinan. One sheet, the Rav says that we're not worried about if you eat the barley wheat shisisa, you come to eat the lentil ones. And the other opinion, Levi and Avodah Shmuel were afraid. Okay, it's a detailed question. Now the Gemara gets off on a minor tangent. Amar Rav, treimini shisisa shada barzila agiladi ledavid. Barzila, after David fled the Avshalom rebellion, after Avshalom was killed, so David came back. Before he came back, however, he needed supplies. So he had some people who were still loyal to him, and Barzillai HaGiladi was one of his big patrons. And he sent them stuff. So Rav says that he sent them two kinds of shisisa. Now, you're wondering, what in God's name is this doing, and where they come up with this? So really what Rav is answering is a problem in the Pasuk. And the Pasuk says as follows, Dichsiv. Mishkav v'sipos v'chol yotzer chitimu sorim v'kemach v'kali upul v'adashim v'kali. So kali is mentioned twice as a separate entity. First it's chitimu sorim v'kemach v'kali, then upul v'adashim v'kali. So Rav says yes. First he sent him chitimu sorim and the kali made from those things. That's one kind of shisisa. And then he sent them pol, beans, and adashim, or lentils, and then kali, the shisisa, made from the lentils. Okay. What's Rav really doing here? Rav's to explain. Rav is bothered by the pasuk. Why does it say the kali twice? The answer is two kinds of kali. Fine. So now the Gemara says, in classic fashion, v'hashtahu dekamapke tzani tzani l'shuka denarda. In this day and age, they bring out baskets full of this stuff, of shisisa, presumably of wheat and barley, to sell in the shuk of in the marketplaces of Narda, v'les techayish lahadavu ad Shmuel v'Levi. Nobody is choshesh for Shmuel, and of all the Levi's concern, everybody follows Rav Shita. They would buy the shisisa made from the wheat and the barley because they don't put vinegar in that. Just close with one comment. I mentioned this before. We're almost probably one of the last times I'm going to mention it. We don't assume that goyim go around looking to put tray food in our food. The concern that we have outside of Yayin Nesach in its own right, because we do assume, true or not true today, but the assumption was then that goyim took every opportunity to consecrate wine to their gods. Outside of that, the assumption is that goyim is only going to put something non-kosher. He's only going to put wine into a food. He's only going to swap his cheese for your cheese if it is the norm or there is a strong financial incentive to do so. If the kosher product is the same expense as the treif product, we don't assume, and you give a guy, you entrust him, you know, to, let's say, to keep watch on your refrigerator for you, we don't assume that he's going to swap them because there's nothing in it for him, right? If, in fact, your cheese is incredibly valuable, it's just like $50 a pound cheese, he might substitute a cheaper version, so then you have to be concerned. In the same way, we don't assume that they deliberately put wine in the food just so they can put wine in the food so Jews can't eat it or so it would be in a treif, but rather they only put wine in the food if that's the normal thing to do. If it's not the normal thing to do, we simply don't assume that, and it's not a problem. Okay.